Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizwan, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins and Genevieve Kim. Welcome, everybody. The quote of the day of the week that we are covering is by Giovanni Botero from The Reason of the State, and it reads, "Valor increases with the quality of the arms, defensive as well as offensive." Guys, what's your take on this?
Valor increases with the quality of the arms, defensive as well as offensive. So most of us listening to this, I'm going to assume, are civilians, and we don't walk around with swords on our hip. And but in the Renaissance, it was considered part of your dress, if you were a nobleman, to wear a sword, and it was actually an ornament. And this is something that I guess if you're like a gun collector, especially of like guns from like the Civil War period or the Revolutionary War period or older, like you think about these things, these objects, as having an aesthetic to them, not just as having a utility to them. A little bit hard for us who are more civilian to relate to the idea that like a weapon or something that was used to end life could also have a certain beauty to it. But these things were super well decorated. And if you look at the Talmud, there's actually an amazing debate about whether a person can carry a sword on Sabbath that relates exactly to this point, which is that if the sword is seen as an ornament, as a decoration, then it's permitted. But if it's seen primarily as a weapon, then it's not permitted. You just remember that if you are showing up to a ballroom dance or some kind of concert, you might have a sword on you. And it wasn't necessarily because you thought you were going to get in a fight, but because there was a certain valor, to be old school about it, in dressing up in that way. So when we're talking about the valor increases with the quality of the arms, defensive as well as offensive, you can interpret it narrowly as in if you're dressed for battle, then you'll feel more confident in battle. But I think even if you're dressed for battle and you're not going to battle, there's a sense of just being armed and the confidence that that gives you. So maybe we should talk about valor. What is valor? And also what this might mean for us metaphorically, given that we don't live in Renaissance Italy. What do you think, Genevieve?
When I think about arms, I also think about the quality of the arms is the person who's actually wielding them. And say we're talking about a sword, right? And so if you have a sword, it's not just enough that you have a really sharp blade, but that you also need to have the mental alacrity and like the agility and also the strategy to wield it. So I think in that essence, it's not just the tool itself, but also the user and the mind that's behind it.
When you think of King Arthur pulling Excalibur from the stone, and there's the chicken or egg question of, does King Arthur pull the sword from the stone because he's already King Arthur and thus it's his destiny? Or does the act of pulling the sword from the stone produce King Arthur? And per Botero, he becomes a new person as a result of now wielding the sword.
Yeah. He becomes an identifier. Like, what comes first, the lightsaber or the Jedi? Which one do we, see the lightsaber, you're like, Jedi. Person doesn't have a lightsaber, you're like, who's that?
I think this is deeply connected to dress in some way and fashion. Well, that's one literal application of this idea. You're a different person when you're in a dress for a black tie event as when you're dressed for the beach. If you look at I always go back to the Bible, but Leviticus, the priests had a special costume that they had to wear when they were in the temple. And it's said to everybody around them, hey, I'm a priest. And the high priest in particular had this like very ornate bling on a breastplate that had all these precious and semi-precious gemstones on it. And there are all these laws about how to make the clothes and who should put the clothes on the guy. And this very much seems to tie into the idea of valor increasing with the quality of the arms, in the sense that the same person not dressed in this way would just not have a sense of importance. We wouldn't ascribe that importance to that person. That person wouldn't ascribe it to himself. So there's an element of a dress up here. And I think you can relate to that, Cyrus, like since actors play dress up. How much do you know when you're playing dress up? And there's like an element of winking going on. And how much do you actually buy in and you forget because your identity is just a function of the role that you're playing?
Yeah, you said you keep going to biblical tradition. I said, oh, I keep going back to the acting practices. If we substitute valor with confidence, performance confidence, then it absolutely goes up with the quality of the arms. That wink certainly retreats farther into the back of your mind the more authentic your costume is. If you're in a police uniform or let's say a military uniform, let's say Vietnam period, I was in a play set in Vietnam, they gave us actual flak jackets. At first they gave us these little fake ones, and they were light, and there was rehearsal clothes, and you acting all silly with like wooden little gun props. And then one day, the costume department gave us actual flak jackets, actual greens, guns that were stopped from firing, but they're actual guns. And we had real cigarettes and all the whole thing. And all of a sudden, it was like, whoa, this is what they wore. There was added layers of authenticity, of realism. And it became so much easier to get into character. It was so much easier, felt so much real. And obviously I wasn't watching from the outside, but I'm assuming the quality went up. Actually, I did get to watch from the outside scenes I wasn't in, and the performance went up. So I definitely could see this quote applied in the acting context to be more or less accurate. I guess I'm interpreting valor here as confidence. And I think valor's confidence in arms, wouldn't you? Confidence in war or conflict, wouldn't you say?
I think valor is associated with glory and whether you feel activated by what you're doing. Is your heart in it? Do you feel that it's what you're meant to be doing? Are you in the zone? Or are you just doing it because you're told to do it, or you're going through the motions, or you're trying to get some external award? So I think the sense of when you feel a sense of self-importance, not in a sense of egotism, but in a sense of the universe is almost like pausing and putting the spotlight on you just for that moment. And it's like Eminem says,
you only get one shot.
And this is your shot. I think that's the valor effect. Again, a Jewish tradition, bride and groom have a sense of valor on their wedding day. And you as the participant in the wedding have an obligation to create that valor effect around them. You're obligated as a wedding attendee to treat the bride and groom like king and queen and make them feel the sense of happiness. Almost, and they in turn bestow blessings as if the power of the day has given them this special ability that they otherwise wouldn't have. They're just tapped in. And obviously weddings are filled with pomp and circumstance and arms in this broad sense, whether it's the bouquets or all the other aesthetics that go into it. Yeah, there seems to be a through line with acting here in the sense of the more of a production you make of a scene, the more production value there is, the more people feel a sense of being empowered and being special.
Yeah.
I think the counter argument to this, I have a couple counter arguments. One is take the American Revolution. The founding fathers were guerrilla warriors. They didn't wear beautiful outfits. And the British Army had tremendous valor and had a great march and all this, and they lost. So again, I guess maybe it's not a critique on my point because valor doesn't mean victory. You could have valor and lose. You could be a valorous loser. But then the question is, so why should you care about valor? Shouldn't you care about winning? Because presumably this guy's a political philosopher. He's giving advice to rulers on capital allocation ultimately, right? And the idea is like you want to compensate your warriors by giving them a sense of importance so that they can perform better. And that's where the question would be is do the arms actually drive performance or do they just drive self-importance?
Bravado.
Performance versus bravado. Yeah. The Russian army, I'm not trying to be political, but like you have many armies that invest quite a bit in arms. And by the arms, I don't mean the weaponry only, like the beautiful getup, the kit. Yeah. Those armies, though, are in danger of playing dress up and actually relating to what they're doing as actors. And then the question is, okay, fine, you've been acting because you've been in training for your entire career, and now it's time to actually fight. How we this time it's real as opposed to just another play, another production.
Yeah. And at what point do you make the training real enough? You know? Yeah, I think the Revolutionary War is like a peak example. What if the quote's very, in the context of the quote, it's very specifically saying the arms. This is a guy from Renaissance Italy. There's constant vying of power between the states, the Italian states. But what if we could interpret arms for the arming of the mind, like arming of purpose? I would say the Americans, the colonists, had a far greater purpose instilled in them than the British soldiers, many of which were just mercenaries from other European countries. To them, it was just like, oh, here's another rebellion. We're here to put it down. I'm thousands and thousands of miles away from my family. For the king and the empire and all that. But to the Americans, it was like, this is our destiny. Like, it's a do or die. We're underdogs against the great titan of the world. We have God and freedom on our side. Whatever their generals taught them, they had all these, they were reading the Federalist Papers, or at least having the Federalist Papers read to them up to this point, and the Declaration of Independence and all that. And the idea that their leaders' lives were on the line and at stake as well by signing this document. They're all effectively branded themselves traitors to the crown. So I think that is in itself a kind of equipping of a mindset, because that, like Genevieve was saying, also you think of arms, it's not just a weapon, but what's wielding the weapon? The mind is, you know, and that mind is persevering through a charge instead of breaking. Trusting that, no, I need to hold this position, like I have to, because this is at stake. These are the stakes. Yeah. But then if we take it literally, then maybe, we're just talking about arms, then valor increases, but other things can decrease the valor. And then you could point to the reasons as something separate from the arms and say, their cause was less, therefore their valor decreased as well.
Yeah.
There's a scale, and there's different things influencing.
We have a number of interpretive choices. One is to focus on whether arms is narrow or expansive. The other, though, is to focus on the word valor and whether valor is the thing that we want to increase. Maybe, so we have in the Chronicles chat a discussion about this right now. And Nico gave the example of picking up a date in a Ferrari versus in a Prius, and suggesting that he would be a man of valor if he could show up in a Ferrari. And this other person wrote, Chloe, if you're listening, hey, if someone tried to pick me up in a Ferrari, I'd run the other way. It's not a good flex, because I know that you're trying too hard. I don't want a person that's trying to show me that they're a person of valor. I just want a natural. So I'm putting some words in your mouth. So perhaps the question is not whether there's valor, but whether the valor is appropriate, whether the signal that you're trying to signal with your weapon or with your clothing is suitable, which is interesting. The word suit, like wearing a suit, and is the suit suitable? I hadn't made the connection before, but perhaps like a Ferrari is only well suited to a very specific kind of person, but otherwise it's like, is it offensive to say this? Ozempic skinny.
You love this Ozempic quote in all the meditations. I love it. Yeah, it's it's like seeing a nail and you're getting a sledgehammer to pound it in. It's oversized. It's disproportionate.
I think I can reconcile all this by giving a spiritual overlay, if you will. So we have two realms in which we can be successful. We have a material realm, which is the realm that many people care about. How much stuff you have, or how much prestige you have, or what some metric that people are just like, oh yeah, that's great, I want it too. And then the spiritual realm, which is really your sense of, how joyous am I? How blessed am I? How connected to the source am I? And you have people who have very little, and by the way of material wealth or prestige, who feel deeply grateful and deeply blessed and deeply hopeful. And you have plenty of people who are very successful by the sort of fake superficial metrics, who are deeply unhappy and deeply on edge and don't feel blessed. And so what if valor refers to the quality of your spirit rather than your external quality? And this is a comment on the relationship between the arms, which are material, but maybe at the boundary between the spiritual and the material, and then the inner world. And it's a cliche to say that the eyes are windows into the soul, but we express our spirit in our face. So what if the valor is literally like your physiognomy, your visage, your countenance? Are you the kind of person that walks into a room and people see in your face, this is a person of valor? Or are you a person who walks into a room and people are like, get me out of this person's line of fire, they're a downer, or whatever? If you have valor, then you don't need arms. You just have your valor. But for the average person, there are certain things you can do, certain tricks to increase your valor, at least on some relative basis, like whether it's doing a power pose, which is literally the quality of your arms, if you think about it, or whether it's some other trick, taking an energy shot or whatever, I don't know, your upper of choice, or whether it's meditating or something. But yeah, there's got to be some preparation for battle. And the battle here is no longer the battle of warfare, but like the battle of just walking into a room and engaging in energy warfare. Are you going to be a person that other people bring down, or are you going to be a person who brings other people up? What do you think, Genevieve?
What this makes me think is, maybe instead of valor, could you replace the word with virtue? And if you replace it with the word virtue, then it comes down to ethics and honor, right? So it's less about, I don't necessarily look at it as observer versus subject, but looking at it from what is the intention or what is the motive behind the one wielding the arms. So a little different.
If the arms are being wielded for a noble purpose, then you'll be, I think my point is that you'll display it in some way. Your face will be illuminated. As a result. And if so, yeah, so now we're talking about the quality of the arms. What makes for quality arms versus lack of quality arms? If you think about the quality of the arms in terms of the motivation for what you're trying to accomplish, then I guess having a noble motivation or an authentic motivation would improve the luminosity of the one who's carrying that motivation. And if the motivation is not a good motivation, then that too will show up in some way. I guess it's interesting because maybe I've contradicted myself, but I'm almost interpreting valor now as hyper-physical. It's a spiritual thing that is evident in your physique, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can tell from a person's posture, what is their relationship to the world? Are they shut down? Are they afraid? Or are they like open and excited? And so maybe that's the valor, and the arms are whatever conditions, whether you want to think about it as clothing, whether you want to think about it as motivation, whatever it is that enables that person to be on in their game.
Yeah. When boxing or competing in jiu-jitsu, if you go into the match feeling like, oh, I don't want to fight this guy, you are weaker. Like, you just, that thought that you just, your body gives out sooner. But if you go in, maybe you don't even have to think, I'm going to own this guy. But if you go in thinking, I may not win, but I'm going to make it such an event, then it gives you an intangible extra bit of fuel to not give up the round.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of Theoden from the Lord of the Rings. Are you guys familiar with King Theoden of Rohan? There in the second movie in the Two Towers, when Helm's Deep is being overrun by the army of Isengard, they're going to lose, or they're hiding in Helm's Deep, their castle. And Aragorn is telling King Theoden, we can't stay here. We got to leave. We need to call for aid for Gondor. And he's telling him no one will come. And then Theoden's saying, what would you have me do? Look at my people. Like, they're scared and at their wit's end. What would you have me do? If this is going to be our end, I would have them make it such an end as to be worthy of remembrance. And ultimately, that idea of, if this is going to be our end, we're going to make it worthy of song, actually buys them enough time for Gandalf to come with the reinforcement army and save the day. But if they didn't have that little bit extra bit of bravado, of valor, they would have lost. They would have died.
I've got a question for the group. We're all relatively dressed casually right now. I'm wearing a long sleeve shirt. Genevieve's wearing a sweater. Cyrus is wearing a sweater. This is the uniform, this casual look. This is the uniform of those blessed enough to be remote knowledge workers. Mark Zuckerberg wears a black t-shirt, that kind of thing, right? There's been a reverse trend over the past 50 to 100 years where our dress has gotten as a whole more casual, and also it's become a flex, a kind of status flex, to be more casual the more powerful you are, and in a way to hide your power behind this veneer of casualness. If you wear a tie, it's almost because you have to wear a tie, so therefore you can't really be that powerful. But the ability not to wear a tie means that you're your own boss, right? Like, you go to a bank, and like the people that are there at the bank, like taking your deposits, like they have to dress up. So anyways, my question is, for most of human history, we seem to appreciate this idea of valor increasing with the quality of the arms, and actually mandating on some level, both explicitly and implicitly, a dress code. But now we have this weird thing where the dress code is an anti-dress code. And nobody knows what business casual means.
Yeah.
What is the effect of that on our relationship to valor? And could it be that our inability to fully resonate with this quote or appreciate the quote has to do with a declining emphasis in our culture on valor and on formality?
Yeah, we become almost cynical. I want to give Genevieve a chance to say something.
You know, it's really interesting because I still haven't fully digested the idea of valor being about physicality, especially when I think about the context of who said this quote, Giovanni Botero. And when I think about this, is probably there's some element of governing state, right? Or governing, or thinking about, like, how does one be a good diplomat, right? Or how does one be, how is one a good ruler? And I think of valor less of as a physical sense. And in fact, clothing could actually be in arms, right? And so in this context, I think of valor as having fortitude, in essence, like your fortitude or your ability to have perseverance or resilience or resolve. It gets firmer and stronger when one has preparedness, which when valor increases alongside preparation, etc., the quality of the arms, then therefore you're able to make better decisions, whether they are defensive or offensive. And perhaps this is a little too literal, but I see this as a way to rule. And it makes me think of Sun Tzu's, one of his quotes, which is like, the supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. So in essence, like, you're having the power of strategy and intelligence over, say, direct confrontation is aligning with the idea of the quality of one's arms, in this case, strategic knowledge, can really influence someone's success. And if I took the analogy that you're using with clothing, I think it's, if you are to posture yourself in such a way that presents yourself, almost like the saying goes, a fake it till you make it, if you are able to, right, present in such a way, then perhaps your own resolve increases. And that might help with the fortitude. And I go back to more of this like literal interpretation, because I think the etymology of valor is valere, which is like for Latin for to be strong. And so to me, it is very much it's a qualitative aspect, less of a physical analogy, so to speak. That's my thought on what we really mean by valor.
Why does the military insist on generals wearing fancier and fancier uniforms the more high status they are? That seems, if literal, expression of our quote. And hospitals have doctors in white jackets with the proverbial stethoscope or whatever, something to distinguish them. And yet in other contexts, such as Silicon Valley, which claim to be non-hierarchical but are, it's gauche. It's gauche to wear a suit, unless you're the general counsel. And you almost try to hide the fact that you are the five-star general, because that is considered trying too hard. I think that my question is just about what happens to our relationship to valor in contexts where the hierarchy is not explicit. And yet because we are hierarchical beings, and I think that glory is related to status on some level, even if the relationship is complex. If you win the gold medal, that's better than the silver medal. But it's not always easy to know what is the gold medal. I think that's the point, is that we live in a society and a time where, unless you're privileged enough to be a doctor or a general, it's hard to know, or an Olympian, it's hard to know, okay, what is the swag that I get to wear at the end of this? In fact, your reward is that you have to hide your swag, because it's considered tacky to put it on. I get a PhD. I don't walk around in my doctoral robes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The hiding of the swag is, I think it's like, it's a fascination or a love of the underdog aspect to things. Like, some historical example, one of the only historical examples I can think of, and maybe it's not right to do so, but it's like Jesus Christ, who's blessed are the poor and the meek, and that message of it is the impoverished who are mighty. No, it's constantly a message of inverses. And then maybe also the Buddha, Gautama, I forget his whole name.
Buddhist monks do wear robes, though, that signify that they're monks.
I'm curious when that tradition started, but like eschewing of things, and that being, they wear robes, but they're meant to be simple robes that not dressed in ornament.
Just think about this example for a second. Like Oxford, so I went to Oxford for my doctorate. They have a very strict dress code for your doctoral defense. Now, do they actually keep the law that's on the books? That I don't know, but I didn't want to risk it. Like, going to be very vulnerable for a second and share that I had nightmares for months leading up to my defense.
I bet.
That I would not have the right shoes, and that I would not be allowed to defend my dissertation because my shoes were not the right style. I'm sure that's this is a common dream that people have in terms of underconfidence or just
the waking up naked in school.
But I didn't have an anxiety nightmare that they will ask me a question I didn't know the answer to. I had a nightmare that I would be dinged on some dress code formality, which is just interesting. And I had to go out and spend hundreds of pounds on the proper attire and obsessed for hours about like making sure that I had every little piece of my outfit down to the detail. Like I wore a tuxedo to my dissertation defense, plus doctoral robes on top of it. And in some sense, it did give an exaltation to the moment that you do feel a sense of valor because of the gravitas that goes into that. But then it's over, you pass, and then what? And in medieval times, you get your doctoral dissertation, and now you've been anointed a wizard, and you get to walk around for the rest of your life as a wizard. But where's my tux now? Where's my robes now? And on some level, it's a choice. You could say, no, I'm going to wear them all the time, but you'd get very weird looks. Like none of the professors are dressed this way. So they all dress up for one day and then they put it in the closet. And we used to not play dress up. We used to, said differently, there was no costume change. Like you always dressed to the heels.
Well, are we sure it was like maybe it's just an element of ritual to it, like putting on the robes, like it is meant to be different. Going way back to your example of the ornaments of weapons, at least in Greek and Roman and Persian examples that I know of, those ornamented chest pieces and helmets and swords were not used in battle. They were used for parades. And they had a separate, more functional gear for everyday use. And then they had the special ones for like ritual purposes for, so maybe it's just the same. And it's actually not that we're,
yeah,
we haven't lost that.
It's a good critique, but I feel that like there's a hollowed out middle. One might like some continuity between the ritual and the day after the ritual. Otherwise it feels merely ritualistic. Like I think a lot of people eye roll at ritual because they think that it's merely a performance as opposed to a performance. So
there's nothing changed afterwards once you revert all the way back.
I'd like to believe in magic a little bit as opposed to just signaling that, yeah, once upon a time we did magic and now we do it because that's what we do. We're traditional like one day a year. But I'm not about to put myself out there and start wearing robes. But I think I have a little fake nostalgia to live in a world where maybe there would be a little bit more formality. I think it would increase valor both in yourself and also looking at other people. Would give you a certain, it would clue you in to a certain attunement. And I think we've lost that. And now we reach for more metaphorical and figurative relationships to valor, but there's far less definition and clarity around it. And so we're much more casual.
Yeah. It's also how you carry yourself. Maybe it's because we live in a world that anyone can put these things on. You can buy robes and put them on. You can get a tux and you can get a tie. So therefore, their impressiveness is diminished. So then it's like the next level of, okay, what can you not just, anyone can just acquire? And it's, oh, like subtlety of taste.
Yeah. Yeah. You just made me, I think this was actually one of my snarky comments on the quote, but maybe the valor increases today with your Apple Vision Pro or your NFT that you put on your profile, or like there's always going to be a market. Here I'm missing Nico, but there's always going to be a market for some kind of luxury or some kind of vanguard. But it's just the nature of what that is has moved to the tech sector as opposed to the military sector or the fashion sector. Because we have fast fashion now and we don't live in societies where the Western world hasn't really mobilized for war at a great level since World War II. And so it's become, we have a gestural sense of it's noble to be in the military, but I don't think we have the same honor that we ascribe to it as we did 50 plus years ago. Maybe tech is now the sector where there's some honor. Although ironically enough, again, I think tech, it has this sort of like anti-honor vibe. So it's like if you talk too much about honor or suggest that you're interested in it, then somehow you're becoming eligible.
Yeah.
It's like a hipster thing too. Almost like you don't want to try too hard. You guys know that meme where this thing goes hard? Like this quote goes hard. It's like a way of it is people say it as like a approval and a criticism. Wow, I can't believe they just went for it. As I recently saw a clip of a guy who was racing like on foot, and then he does a long jump and he's doing it with a blindfold and going at full speed, and then he just jumps onto concrete because he didn't and it's that's what people think of as going hard. And I think that's a vivid example of how people think of valor in a way. So just take off the blindfold, and at the same time you have to appreciate the effort that you put in, even if it's silly.
Genevieve, do you feel resolved on this quote? Do you feel, has it sunk in? Valor, the concept of valor.
It still
troubles you, huh? Yeah.
It still troubles me that we're tying it so much to clothing. And perhaps this is a massive gap. Maybe I just didn't hear it correctly.
I think, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, valor, I don't think the quote is saying valor is a physical thing.
No, I'm not saying the quote is saying that. I'm saying that as we went on to talking about fashion, we talk about uniforms, and we talked about the way people dress, right? Mm-hmm. That was to Zohar's point. And I think of it more as a quality, a character, like forging someone's character. And perhaps I need the bridge where we got to this and why we got to talking about the Oxford uniform. I take it to be more of a character, this quote being about character and how you build it and in what ways it can help you. That's it.
No, I know Zohar has to go, but I think it is character, but in what Zohar said about in the Jewish tradition, like the bride and the groom are the kings and queens for the day. It's a character thing that's ephemeral, that only it's an emotion. It's Aristeia. I remember, again, reminded of Lord of the Rings, pulled up a quote from Lord of the Rings of the ride of the Rohirrim in the Return of the King, when Rohan comes to save Gondor, their army arrives and the horn is blown. Their army arrives and the city's being overtaken by orcs. And it says, at that sound, the bent shape of the king sprang suddenly erect. Tall and proud he seemed again, and rising in his stirrups, he cried in a loud voice, more clear than any there had ever heard a mortal man achieve before. Arise, arise, riders of Theoden, fell deeds awake, fire and slaughter, spears shall be shaken, shield be splintered, a sword day, a red day, ere the sun rises, ride now, ride to Gondor. With that he seized a great horn from Guthalf, his banner-bearer, and blew such a blast upon it that it burst asunder. And straight away all the horns in the host were lifted up in music, and the blowing of the horns of Rohan in that hour was like a storm upon the plain and a thunder in the mountains. Ride now, ride to Gondor. Suddenly the king cried to Snowmane, and the horse sprang away. Behind him his banner blew in the wind, white horse upon a field of green, but he outpaced it. After him thundered the knights of his house, but he was ever before them. Éomer rode there, and the white horse tail upon his helm flowed in his speed. And the front of the first Eored roared like a breaker foaming to the shore. But Theoden could not be overtaken. Fey he seemed, or the battle fury of his fathers ran like new fire in his veins. And he was born upon Snowmane like a god of old, even as Orome the Great in the Battle of the Valar when the world was young. And it goes on and on. But he's clearly becoming an avatar of this valor, that this valor is like transforming him in this moment. He's an old king whose glory wishes for the golden days, the good old days, past his prime. It's the moment that seizes him. Yeah, Don Quixote.
What about Don Quixote and Sancho? Because we all know who the mastermind behind that pair was.
Yeah.
And one of them was wearing a really nice shiny uniform and the other was a peasant. It's interesting.
You all continue right. if you want, Jen.
How would you respond to that, Zohar? Because I know it's like Don Quixote was in The Shining, right? He had the status, but we know the brains behind was in much, it was Sancho, and he was a mere peasant.
I don't think Sancho Panza had valor. I think Don Quixote did. This is just my take. And I'm not sure that valor is the be all and end all. I think it's a complicated concept. And we can see the positives of having valor as well as the negatives. The positives are the sense of exuberance and the sense of confidence that you get when you're a person of valor. And the negatives are the delusion that somehow just because you feel self-important that actually you know anything. Don Quixote was a person who, with valor, chased after windmills, and it's laughable. In the same way that the person who picks up a date in the Ferrari and is super gauche is also a Don Quixote, and maybe the Prius would have worked just fine. And so I think that Sancho Panza is a little bit like a homebrewed, and that's great, but I don't think being homebrewed is the same as valor. So I see it more as there's different modes of charisma, and some are overt and in a way off-putting because they're so like cheesy, and other forms that are more subtle that take you by surprise. And you can criticize both. You can criticize the sort of high production, cheesy person as being all schmaltz and no substance. You can criticize the Sancho Panzas for not putting a little bit more effort in. And if you had just tweaked the presentation, you would have had more impact. Valor sells. It's a good mass market value, I think.
Yeah. You were saying it, we can perceive it as cheesy. It's probably just, I would say it's for a certain moment. Valor is for a kind of situation. And when we have valor, when it's not really warranted, then that's where the cheesiness comes in, because you're using the wrong tool, the wrong emotion, the wrong gesture.
You know, we're not writing to save gun. On the internet, it's subjective whether it's appropriate or not, because you can always find your people that will reinforce what you're doing and tell you that it's great while other people are cringing. So then it just becomes a question of, are those your people, and is that your intent? And
the internet's but it's like it's a total game changer. It's like those same people, you took them all and put them in the same room, they're not going to respond the same way to you doing that. The anonymity and the distance provided by the internet, if you put them in a room and then you also mix them in with, allow them to be criticized as well for supporting you, then let's see like how that conversation happens again. You know, your people on the internet is just like all the versions of you, like the 1 out of 50 in many different communities and groups that are then congregated and removed like out of the social network. So it's like the reactions you get online are like very unnatural. I don't know if unnatural is the right word, but
I'll tell you why I relate to this literally, even though I don't relate to it as merely literally. Because both fashion and war are about other people's perceptions of you. And there is no such thing as innate strength, especially in war. Like, it's quite postmodern. Your strength really is a function of the combination of your self-perception and how other people react to the combination of your self-perception and their evaluation of whether your self-perception is accurate. And it's like poker. If you have a strong hand, you don't want to show it. And if you don't have a strong hand, then you want others to believe that you have it. And the same is true with fashion. There's like an element of bluff, you could argue, in any fancy outfit. I think that's true. I think there's a lot of social dynamics that are like game theory in this regard. And we never actually know where we stand. Edward Lutbach says about war that one of the paradoxes is that in any war, you never know whether you're winning or losing. And you always stand in a situation where actually by virtue of being in the losing position, you have the advantage because the enemy suspects that it's going to defeat you and thus doesn't see its own blind spot.
I think we've extracted, we've pressed every possible interpretation out of this quote that we can. This decision to talk about this quote was inspired by the fact that we are discussing this quote in Chronicles in our group chat. And the debate is, I'm sure they brought up points that we haven't in here today. I know they have, just checking it. Audience members, guys, if you love this sort of stuff, if you listen to this podcast and you want to hear more, join Chronicles. You get to do it every day. It's fantastic. Anyways, thanks for joining, Zohar, Genevieve. Have a great day.